So med school faculty would clearly be teaching the bare minimum of didactic teaching, a few lectures a year, and lots of different cultural expectations. It was informative. It was also exciting just because so much truly fantastic science was being done around this campus. It was very inspiring and a nice kind of work to do. I've also been on some search committees. I chaired the search committee for the Associate Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Climate. We hired Bernice Durand, who I hope, has been interviewed for this oral history project. Mm-hmm. And that was another interesting kind of revelatory experience to hear faculty and students and staff of color talk about what their experience on this campus is like was informative. And I mean, I know the women in science story, and we haven't really talked about gender issues, but they're out there. But the race issues were interesting for me to hear about. And then another piece of campus service that I did was I was an investigator for the provost recently for a faculty member who'd been accused of serious criminal misconduct. And in such cases, the provost is required to hire an investigator to look into the effects of this behavior at the department level and make a decision about whether you can fire somebody for failure to maintain professional integrity, but not necessarily for being a crook, if the criminal behavior is unrelated to their work. And so in this case, my task was to try to figure out if the criminal behavior had affected the workplace. And that was also interesting, although very distressing, because the criminal behavior was very serious in nature and involved people in the department. Had left terrible gouges on the department. And I've been involved with lots of service within my departments. I ran the graduate studies program in Plant Path for 5 years before I got tenure. And I'm associate chair now. So
there's a lot of responsibility in all of that too.
I don't mind doing it if I can be chair. frankly, right. It's just way easier if you're in charge. You're not sitting around waiting for other people to get it together.
Well, you mentioned women in science. I wonder if you would talk about the climate for women here, women in science, women in general. How does it help and or hinder the participation and advancement of women?
It's an issue people are aware of. I mean, when I was a graduate student, it was unmentionable almost. I didn't have the sense that I was doing anything especially unusual by being a woman interested in science until I got into the upper level of graduate school, and I now realize developed enough confidence to be threatening and offensive to senior male faculty. I think before that I was cute and to be encouraged. But I did run into occasional problems with faculty that I think must have had a gender element in it. I remember one faculty member taking me aside, somebody who was on my committee, and saying that I needed to improve my manner because I was offensive. And I said, well, what did I say that was offensive? Was I rude to you? And he said, well, you're just so damn sure of yourself. It's going to put people off, so you'll never get a job. And I'm just telling you this for your own good. He called me into his office. It was a weird interaction. And I realized now that I'd gotten under his skin in some way or another, and he felt entitled to tell me all about it. I can't imagine ever saying anything like that to a graduate student now. Just a piece of friendly advice. And I know when I was a graduate student, I remember sitting around with a handful of other women who were also in the PhD program, trying to figure out how many women faculty there were in plant pathology. And at that time, there were 3 in the whole country. We knew them all. We knew their career histories. None of them had children. None of them were married. And so this was in 83, 84. And many departments had no women faculty, of course. And indeed, when I was at first a graduate student at Wisconsin, I remember asking one of the senior faculty, how come there aren't any women professors? And this guy said, we tried that once, it didn't work out. And I found out later that it was a woman named Aaliyah Haley, who I'm told was hired briefly in the 70s, ABD, that is to say without finishing her dissertation. Way to shoot somebody in the foot right off the get-go, right? And then had a baby. And that was it. That was it. She didn't, I don't know if they just, they didn't renew her. She never even came up for tenure. I think she may have lasted a couple, 3 years. I'm not sure. Didn't work out.
Now, what's the situation today in the department?
We now actually have the best representation of women of any plant path department in the country. There are 7 of us out of a total faculty of 20, I believe. And we constitute an unspoken voting block on hiring issues, although not on anything else. We're a very diverse group, but I have noticed, although we have never talked about it amongst ourselves, that there have been a number of occasions when a hiring vote has been split between 2 male candidates. The women have voted for the female candidate, and we've hired her. So we've now gotten to that point where gender can be left off the table. There are so many different models of successful science among our women faculty that it's not constraining anymore. Mm-hmm. There are faculty with no kids. There are faculty with 3 kids. There are married faculty. There are unmarried faculty. There are research aces. There are people who've got respectable middle-of-the-road careers. There's the gamut mm-hmm. in terms of personality, too. So it's a non-issue in our department now. It's not to say that in individual interactions there aren't gender issues. You bet there are. But globally in the whole department, it's okay now. Mm-hmm. And we have, at the moment anyway, a very enlightened chair who's supportive of women in science. But the larger issues almost go beyond the campus. The culture of science still remains one of intense competition and scramble for limited funding resources, many labs working together on a single hot topic such that only one can get the credit and the others lose. Not enough jobs. You know, it's a daunting prospect. Many scientists work insane hours and have no balance in their lives. They don't do anything else. Or if they have kids, that's the only thing they have. They've got their family and they have their work and they don't do anything else. They don't have a hobby. They haven't read a novel in 20 years. They don't go to the theater, nothing. They're narrow. So you don't want to have them to dinner on your incapable of normal human interaction. So what kind of a model are we offering to our graduate students, both male and female, if they, and students are extremely cognizant of that, and I've had students say, I don't want your life. And to be fair to myself, I like my life. I know that I work hard, but I don't work like a demon. And some of my colleagues do work all the time, but I don't. And it's a pleasure to me when I do work. I'm excited about my research and I love teaching. So it's not, there are days when it's drudgery, but most of the time I'm lucky to have this job. So, but the students are looking at it and they're thinking, this doesn't look like a nice life to me. They have, in some cases, very unrealistic ideas. They think, oh, I'll go teach at a small liberal arts school and then I'll have a nice life. But then you get somebody from a small liberal arts school to come and talk about what it's like to teach 4 classes a semester year in, year out, and maybe that's not what I want. So, but those are gender issues, those lifestyle issues. however unfair it may be, women still are responsible for making sure the house is clean and that the kid has the permission slip to go to the field trip and the 50 cents in the morning, and somebody's outgrown their shoes, they need, you know, to make sure they have shoes by Friday night when the soccer game is. And, you know, you're running a whole parallel file of facts in your brain to keep the family operational at the same time that you're also trying to keep track of research grant deadlines and your teaching schedule and personnel issues at work. And my male colleagues, some of them, I think, are carrying some portion of the domestic burden, but I think many of them still don't. They think they do, but their wives don't think so. So that's the ultimate gender issue is developing a more humane workplace. And as long as jobs are scarce and money is scarcer, I don't know if we're going to get there. I'm discouraged about it. There's some of it's the culture of science too. We like to think of ourselves as an elite group that lives in almost monastic isolation from the rest of society. We're objective. I mean, this is of course a whole complicated and fruitful academic topic in the social sciences and the humanities, but believe me, most plant pathologists have never heard of postmodernism and no idea what it might be. What was one of my favorite comments from a science colleague was, he was saying, well, you know, it's of course we have to fund the sciences because we do real work. It's not like some guy over in the English department who just has to go to the library and write down whatever he's thinking. So completely dismissive about any other kind of academic.
Dear.
Well, yes. It's funny, that's just what he said about you. If all I had to do was pour colored liquids from one test tube into another, my life would be peaches and cream.
Oh.
So scientists are unselfconscious, let's just say. And that doesn't develop the best kind of workplace.
What about the students who are coming in? Are the students pretty divided in terms of male, female, or are there more male?
There are more female students in our graduate program now, and that's been true for some time. And I believe that this is the case across the campus in most biology graduate programs. However, despite the fact that this has been true for some time, the professoriate remains predominantly male. What happens to those women between the time they finish their PhD and the time that people get hired for an assistant professorship is an interesting question. Mm-hmm. And because you're struggling with the statistics of small numbers where everybody is a special case, because there's no obvious path for a scientific career, it's not an area where the sociology of science has really gotten any traction. Something bad happens to women during their postdoc years. Is as far as anybody's really gotten. And maybe it's that they have children. Maybe it's that they decide they don't like the long hours and they look at their postdoc mentor and say, I don't want her life. Maybe it's that they get married to a husband who puts pressure on them pressure inside a marriage can, you know, be a dirty glance. It doesn't take much.
Right.
That makes them feel that if they pursue a career aggressively, it's going to destabilize their marriage. He's also a scientist, and he gets a job offer somewhere, and she gets a job offer somewhere, and they take his offer because she has the sense that it's going to unman him if it goes the other way. And I know couples where this has happened, where the wife was, by objective standards, the better scientist, got more offers, better offers. They took the one to Podunk U because that was the one he got. And she got a postdoc, soft money funding for a few years. He got the assistant professorship. She gets pregnant, and then she stays home. So
some things never change.
Some things never change. And one of the frustrations of my job is talking to young women in my lab, my technicians and my graduate students, who, without exception, feel that these things do not apply to them. And I felt that way too when I was 24. I made, as I've told you, a dumb career move because of my soon-to-be ex-husband. I mean, the ironies are not lost on me. And I can remember an older female colleague at Virginia saying, you know, you just get one career, but then the world is full of nice men. And at the time, I thought, oh, well, she's just a bitter old thing. And luckily for me, I ran into her at a women's studies conference a few years ago. I said, oh, God, Muriel, you were so right. Oh, they never listened to me, she said. I said, I know now, they don't listen to me either. But one of my male colleagues with whom I've had frank discussions about this always says, well, I'm not going to tell my students what to do in their private lives. And I do. I mean, I don't tell them what to do, but I offer them input because their private lives are their professional lives. And that's where I think my colleague is thick-headed, that women make personal decisions that deep-six their professional lives. And they don't always do so with a full acknowledgement of what they're deciding, what they're giving up. Mm-hmm. And they all think that it's just totally different for them. Yeah. We're so in love.
And then time goes on and reality sets.
Oh, yes.
Well, let's switch into another direction. If you would talk about professional organizations that you're involved with and how important that is to your career, and what are some of the activities that you particularly enjoy, don't enjoy involving this?
Yeah. The single most important professional society for me is, it doesn't really have a name, it's the group that meets every 4 years at the International Bacterial Wilt Symposium. And this is a group of, around 100 scientists from around the world, mixture of very applied people who are fighting this disease on the ground in Africa and India and South and Central America, Asia, and people in sterile, well-funded laboratories in Europe and North America, who are Japan, who are studying the basic biology of the pathogen. And it's a very fertile thing that we meet and talk to each other and listen to each other. And I've made important collaborative connections with this group. I co-organized the 1998 meeting, which is in the French West Indies, and also the 2002 meeting, which was in South Africa. And those were both really great experiences. And I co-edited the books that came out of both those meetings. Never do that again. I'm at the end of the line of the book editing. That's a piece of advice I give for free to any young faculty member. Don't get tangled up in a book. It's for the sciences. It's not a useful investment of time. That's an old person's job. That's a great organization because it just put me in contact with such a diversity of researchers with an interest in this, and made it possible to exchange strains and forced me to read a new literature that I hadn't known before. So that's been a great group. It's a small thing, but I like teaching in Expanding Your Horizons, which is a program that is put on here at the UW one weekend in early November every year, where middle school girls come to the campus and go around and spend an hour or so in a directed activity with different faculty just to get their hands on some science.
Uh-huh.
And that's a fun thing to do. I do it with my daughters. They've both come in and helped me with it when they've been middle schoolers themselves. So, the formal professional societies of my of plant pathology, which are the American Phytopathological Society and the International Society for Molecular Plant Microbe Interactions, are both rather hidebound and traditional organizations. And I'd say the most overt sexism I've encountered in my career has to do with who they choose to edit their journals, be on their advisory boards, and give invited talks at their meetings. They're very narrow in their base. And I haven't exactly felt excluded from those groups, but I certainly haven't felt welcomed. And
do you still have to put in an appearance?
I do, yeah. I go to the APS meetings to represent my department. And sometimes there are interesting things there, and I meet interesting colleagues and former students and things like that. But at this point in my career, I have to say I'm a little bit annoyed that I'm not being asked to give platform talks more often than I am. Mm-hmm. I'm asked to give talks at other institutions and at other meetings, but not in my own professional society. So they're just kind of stuffy. They have a kind of old ag feel about them, especially APS.
Well, the last question before we move into your life after work has to do with honors and awards that you've received. I know you mentioned that you got a teaching award early on in your career.
I did. And then last year I got from APS, no, I should bite my tongue for being so ungrateful, their National Excellence in Teaching Award, which my department nominated me for. That's very nice. I mean, awards like that, the real value is that your department took the time and trouble, and it's a lot of fuss to put together one of those nominations. Mm-hmm. And somebody did that for me. I was very grateful. Mm-hmm. I haven't talked about the WISE dorm. I was the founding director of the Women in Science and Engineering dorm in Liz Waters. Mm-hmm. So that was from 1995 to 2000. And that program won a national award from WEPAN, which is the Women Engineers Professional Something Action Network. It's the National Women Engineering Society. And so they, maybe because I'd written a paper about the WISE dorm that gave some quantitative assessment of how effective it was, mm-hmm. They gave an award to the program. That was really nice. Mm-hmm.
Would you talk a little bit about the WISE dorm?
Yeah, it was formed in a collaboration between me and Dick Barrows, who was then he's the recently retired associate dean for education. It's not exactly right. Student services, something in CALS. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's the curriculum guy in CALS. Mm-hmm. People from the University Housing who were so great to work with. And the idea was to try to address one of the causes of attrition of women who enter college with the intention of pursuing a career in science is loneliness and inability to develop a cohort of other students who are supportive and kind of help you through being in a minority in your science classes and feeling like you have nowhere to go in terms of your career. So we thought maybe one approach to this would be to help them find each other since this university is so big. So Elizabeth Waters was at that time the only remaining all-female dorm on campus. I understand that men will be living there for the first time this fall. And so we got a couple of floors on Liz Waters and created a learning community where women who were intending to major in science or engineering could all live together. And we got the math and chemistry departments. The chemistry department was just great about this. A guy named Gary Essenmacher made it possible for us to create linked sections of introductory chemistry and calculus such that students who were living in the WISE dorm could be in a chemistry lab and a calculus class discussion section with other people on their hall who happened to be female. So they'd be studying for the same quizzes, they'd be lab partners, they'd be writing up reports together. They would create a little community within this much larger university. A freshman year especially, that's a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. And it's been pretty successful. It's persisted all these years. There have been other directors since. We hired a permanent staff person who does a lot of the nuts and bolts, unfortunately harder after I had finished.
Sure.
So
sure.
just in time to miss the perk. And from everything I understand, it continues to be a good model program, self-sustaining and effective. Mm-hmm. So I feel good about that.
Sure.
One of the things, when we tried to assess it, we couldn't get any money from either National Science Foundation or the university to do an assessment. And at that time it was less of a buzzword than it is now. And in the end I was able to get money to do the assessment only because my friend Aaron Brower of the social work department, who was the faculty director of another learning program, the Bradley freshman learning community, had money from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to do a college alcohol binge drinking survey. And Aaron said, if you write your survey in such a way that it includes some binge drinking questions, I'll give you the money from my Robert Wood Johnson money. So that's what we did. And we found out, to our surprise, that living in this dorm significantly reduced binge drinking compared to a matched group of young women who were also apparently headed into science and engineering majors, who were living in either Whitty or Ogg, I can't remember right now, one of the high-rise large dorms, co-ed dorms. And boy, the binge drinking was, I had no idea how much it went on and what dreadful consequences. Even for people who don't drink, just the bad things that are happening in the dorms, and that's a whole other topic. But.
Right. All right, so I've certainly gotten the impression there is life after work for you.
Yeah.
If you would talk about your family, how you balance your work and family, what you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working, how you keep healthy and energetic.
It's never right. It's never enough. It's a perpetual, I'm always out of whack one way or another. I always feel like I'm not spending enough time with my kids, or I'm not spending enough time in the lab, and sometimes I feel like both.
Talk about your kids. You have two daughters.
I have two daughters. Lulu, born in 95, and Cora, born in 1990. So Cora's now 16 and Lulu's now 11. They're great kids. I'm lucky. They haven't, they've been very accommodating. I took Cora to Guatemala with me a couple of years ago. Took her out of high school, and we went down there on a 10-day trip with the Cal's deans in an attempt, successful as it turned out, to create a formal tie between the University of San Carlos and the College of Agriculture, which resulted in some graduate students coming up here from there. But it was nice to be able to, briefly anyway, fuse those two sides of my life. And it was a nice experience for Cora, who is interested in international relations and righting the wrongs in the world and languages, and she's reverted to the family type and is clearly not going to be a scientist. She's also interested in music. Lulu is a much less easily categorized kid, in part because she's younger and in part because she's unformed at this point. Still, she's kind of a wild card. But I think she says that what she's interested in is marine biology, and she's always been interested in animals, so I think there's a chance that she'll end up as a biologist or something.
Are your parents still living?
Yes, they're divorced. My father still lives in Buffalo. My mother lives here. When she retired from University of Delaware Library in 97, I think it was, she came here and lives a few blocks from us. We see her often. Although she's not a big, she loves her grandchildren, but she's not here to serve us. She spends a lot of her time traveling. I can tell you that she always knows what the hot new restaurant in town is before we do. That may tell you all you need to know. She's an active socialite. She's a docent at the Arts Center downtown, involved in Umpty-Umpty book groups, a model of successful aging.
What do you do for hobbies? I know you read.
I read. That's really about, I read and I cook. I think cooking is my main thing. I have a little garden, but I wouldn't want my colleagues to see it. I'll just leave it at that. We go camping. We go hiking and canoeing, and but maybe twice a year. It's always a uphill work to find the time and pull that off. It's a big organizational thing to get a family of four out into the woods for 4 days. You would think it was easier than it is. But I really like to cook. I miss lab work, which I don't do anymore because I'm writing papers and grants and teaching and sitting on committees and everything else. And I think that sometimes the only thing I really know that I did at the end of the day that was successful was produce a meal. So it's a creative act for me. I really enjoy cooking. And also, sometimes I come home from work and I'm tattered and really not fit for human companionship. But if I can have a half an hour in the kitchen to do something constructive, I can rejoin the civilized world.
Understood. Do you have any pets?
No. I have graduate students, children, and a husband. There's no way I'm going to take on responsibility for one more creature.
So you can say no if you have to.
Oh, yes. Yeah, my mother thinks there's something wrong with me because it's not that I don't like dogs. I just don't want one. My hands are full.
Well, I don't have any more questions, but before we end this, is there anything else that you would like to say that we haven't covered?
I wonder if there's some way, in the context of the Oral History Project, to revisit some of the core questions for women in science with women science faculty over the generations to come. Because certainly things have improved for the better. I mean, we were joking before, some things never change. Mm-hmm. But when I look back on the way things were when I was started graduate school in 1981, they were, women were in a very difficult situation. There were women in graduate programs, but there were virtually no women faculty. And those that did have faculty positions had clearly sacrificed. We've made significant progress for women in science, but we're far from equity. So it would be interesting for me in a systematic way to know in 15 years what women at mid-career, like me, are seeing as the most important barriers that remain for women and how that changes over time. I think in the early 60s it was the nepotism laws. There were laws that prevented a married couple from both having a job at the same institution. That was horrible for women in science. And that's gone now. It's not even discussed. But we still have the problems of family, unequal distribution of family labor, which are so personal and specific that, you know, individual families can solve them, but that doesn't solve them except by forming a social model that you hope might eventually penetrate. I try to take my kids to department social events. I have my lab to my house so they see my family life. I think that's important that you make explicit the balance in your life to whatever degree you have it. I think people used to keep their children a secret. One of my senior colleagues, I was in her office one time and she never closed her door. And for some reason or another, she closed her door to open a cabinet or something, and there were all these children's pictures on the back of her door. I said, oh, your kids' drawings. And she had photographs of her kids, too. She said, yeah, I keep them back there, but I don't let anyone else see them because I wouldn't want them to think I wasn't serious. So I think people don't have to do that so much anymore. I've got pictures of my kids on my desk. But I do know that in the time that I've been here, we've interviewed two women who went out of their way explicitly in one-on-one conversations with the faculty in the department during the job interview to tell us that they were not going to have kids. Something that was completely inappropriate, in my opinion, for them to mention. But they had individually, by different senior faculty in their home institutions, been advised to do this. And we're talking 1998. So that kind of thing just makes your blood boil.
Yeah.
But that's reality. It's not there. So anyway, that's just a thought for the larger.
That's a good thought. We do have this Women in Science series back, I think it started in the late 70s, early 80s. So there are a number of women, retired women now, who have been interviewed. And then it stopped, mm-hmm. Mainly because of lack of staff. But now it's starting again, and I think there is a real interest to keep this going, and also to perhaps interview people twice, to come back to you, for example, in 10 years, and ask you some of the same questions, some different questions, so that there is a comparison.
Yeah, that might
across.
Be interesting.
Yeah, so I think I hope we will do more of that, because it's an excellent idea.
Well, I hope the sociologists of science get some traction on some of these questions. Certainly money's being thrown at it. NSF is spending money on things like the Wisely Advanced Project here. Mm-hmm. And different advanced projects have different foci around the country, but this one has done some data gathering. and I hope that they'll continue to do so, and moreover, turn it into a, make it an accessible format where it gets turned into policy or at least into public discussion.
Well, thank you very much. This was an excellent interview, and I really appreciate that you took the time to do it.
You're welcome.